They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Hello, everyone. This is Nate Kaczmarek, and I'm excited to have with me today Chris Connolly, who is a longtime Hill guy and current chief of staff for Congresswoman Vicky Hartzler from Missouri's 4th Congressional District. He's also a friend, so I'm happy he could come off the Hill for a bit and share his thoughts about working there and talk a little bit about the state of our modern Congress. Chris, how are you?
Good. Is this real? Are we really doing a podcast together?
We absolutely are.
All right.
And we can cut out anything that you don't want afterwards. But glad you could be here. As I mentioned, you've worked in D.C. for a while, so let me just tick off your experience for our audience. You started in 1998 with Tom DeLay. After that, you were a policy analyst and press secretary at the National Republican Congressional Committee. Thereafter, you worked as a press secretary for Congressman Chris Smith from New Jersey. Next, you were chief of staff and the comms director for Representative Joanne Davis of Virginia for almost 7 years. After that, you worked for a year as director of communications at the USDA. Next, you served as a senior director of communications and research at the U.S. Chamber of Congress. After that, you were chief of staff for Congressman Scott Ridgel of Virginia for 5 years. And you're now with Representative Vicky Hartzler. And that's been for the last year and a half or so?
All right. Yeah, I'll be 2 years in March.
I know you're originally from the Buffalo area. What made you want to trade all that cold weather and wonderful snow for our nation's capital?
Have you ever been to Buffalo? No.
Now all your family and friends in Buffalo are going to be mad.
Yeah, no. I still have a lot of family up there. No, you know, I went to grad school down in Virginia, and I got my public policy degree, and, you know, it was the natural fit. I always went on to be involved in government and be involved in politics. You know, I was one of these kids at a young age, you know, I was called Alex Keaton in school from Family Ties, you know, making fun of me with my, you know, Ronald Reagan poster in my locker, so to speak. So, you know, it's just always been a thing I wanted to do. I think I was fortunate as a kid to kind of have a good idea of what I wanted to do early on. You know, I think that's always an advantage for kids to kind of have a sense of what you want to do. Mm-hmm. I tell my kids all the time now, you know, try to get an idea of what you want to be when you grow up now, you know, so you can kind of roll into it. So I was fortunate enough to know that, and it just kind of worked out. And after you read that off, it makes me feel really old.
And I noted in your bio, too, there's a lot of communications in your background. How important do you think that skill set is for congressional office today? Do you think it's more so than in the past, or has it always been a factor, especially for a chief of staff?
Yeah, no, I think it's very important. You know, one thing I've learned over the years, too, is, you know, the phrase communication and communications is very different. Communications with the S is a certain discipline of communicating, maybe persuasively, media, writing. Communication, the overall word, is more about how we interact, whether it be interpersonal, whether it be verbal, nonverbal actions, demeanors. That itself, I think, is important at Capitol Hill from a management perspective, right? So we have to be able to know how to communicate, work with reporters, be persuasive, take a message, write, speak. But it's also when you get into the management side of things, it's how you communicate as a person. I've learned, being up in Hill for a while, that if somebody wants to be a manager, if somebody's really into management, they're not coming to Washington, right? They're going to another big city, and they're going to manage at a corporate level. In D.C., you have a lot of political people and legal people who have to figure out how to manage because offices need managers. So I think that's one of the challenges. So, yeah, no, but I do. I think you have to be able to understand people and communicate and everything. I mean, in our office, I say all the time, I mean, I don't care if you're legislative, if you're political, even if you're the scheduler, we're communicators. We got to learn how to communicate. It's important.
So let's talk a little bit to start off just about congressional offices. You know, it's sort of a unique place, the Hill is, and congressional offices are their own unique little world.
Yeah.
And maybe some of our audience members aren't familiar with it. Could you just lay out for us what an individual House member's office is like? In terms of how they're structured, is there variation from office to office, that sort of thing?
Sure. You know, they're antiquated, to be honest with you.
How so?
Well, each member is, I always look at it as we have 435, at least on the House side, small businesses. And we're all advocating for our product. The product is the member. And the member is a compilation of ideas. Mm-hmm. And so in every office, we're advocating for that member, and in each office we have limited resources, understaffed, turnover is getting higher as the years go by because, and we'll probably get into this later, just some of the reforms that have taken place in Congress have actually been counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned understaffed. I mean, how so? You just mean that there's so much volume, there's a great volume of requests and things, and you just don't have the manpower to deal with it?
Yeah, I would say, so you have a member of Congress who, let's say from a scheduling perspective, has representing 900,000 people, requests for scheduling coming in constantly, and you have one person who has to handle all of that. Mm-hmm. You have usually one person that has to handle all of the correspondence, the tens of thousands of emails and letters and phone calls that come in demanding responses. You have one person that has to handle that. You have a handful of people who handle a legislative portfolio of a member who sits on two, sometimes three committees where they have to vote on things. Constituents expect the member to read every bill. I mean, mm-hmm. these bills are thousands of pages. Mm-hmm. You have to really legislate at a very high level with literally a handful of people. Mm-hmm. You have a chief of staff who has to run around and manage it all while at the same time managing a district staff, kind of keeping an eye on a campaign in an unofficial manner. Mm-hmm. These staff sizes haven't changed in decades.
Right.
But yet the workload of Congress has. Mm-hmm. But that's why I say they're antiquated in that we haven't been able to really keep up with the times. And so it's getting harder. And you know, the irony of this all is that, you know, we're the nation's highest legislative body. People entrust us to run this country, and we're doing it understaffed with low resources. The Hill used to be a landing, or the Hill used to be a destination mm-hmm. for professionals. Mm-hmm. Now it's kind of a launching pad, mm-hmm. That's not a good thing.
Right. Did you mention what an individual? I'm sure varies from office to office to some extent, but what kind of budgets are we talking about for individual, you know, roughly?
I would say, you know, the budgets vary somewhat depending on your location. Mm-hmm. There is some fluctuation depending on where a member is, where the member represents. For instance, if a member is representing outside of Los Angeles versus a member that's maybe in rural Oklahoma, the budget will be a little larger because of rent, travel, members who have to fly a lot. So there is a little bit of a fluctuation, but by and large, I think an annual budget's probably about maybe $1.5 million, mm-hmm. Which at first glance sounds like a lot, but you're paying for everything. Right. I mean, we pay an electric bill. We pay a heating bill. We pay cable bill. I mean, it's like literally like a small business. You are paying all kinds of bills. So you pay for everything out of this budget. You pay rent. You pay salaries. You pay for the paper in your printer and the maintenance of a printer coming in or someone coming in fixing your printer. So you pay for everything. So suddenly that budget is not that large at all. Mm-hmm. But I would say that's give or take what we're looking at now.
And I've visited several offices on the Hill, and certainly you're well familiar with them. They tend to be sort of smaller in size for the amount of people that are working in that space.
Work out of closets, literally.
So I would assume that one of your jobs as a chief of staff is trying to keep everyone as a manager working well together in sort of a tight knit union, right? I mean, it's very unique, I would say.
It is. It is very unique.
And what makes for a good congressional staff or a good congressional office? What are some of the traps that maybe some of the underperforming offices fall into?
So I think sometimes it's about understanding what you're getting into. It is not it's not the West Wing. It's not House of Cards, right? It's not House of Cards at all. It's the glamour isn't quite what it used to be either. So you need to, if you're going to go to the Hill, you need to go to the Hill with decent expectations of what you're gonna find. Right, you're gonna find long hours, you're gonna find relatively low pay until you get into the senior levels. Mm-hmm. You're not a lot of glory, but if you care about issues, then that's the place to be. Mm-hmm. If you're driven by the need to feel like you're making a difference, the need to feel like you're in the scrum, then that's the place to be. If you're driven by money, or if you're driven by other motivations professionally, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
I think some offices run into. I think some of the offices that don't have strong managerial people. And like I said earlier, I mean, we're not managers, but we learn on the fly. But I think that the offices that don't take that seriously, I think, run into trouble. I think offices where the member doesn't take that seriously runs into trouble. At the end of the day, you'll find that most offices kind of emulate the member. Maybe not at first.
I see.
But eventually.
So they set the tone.
Yeah, they set the tone. The water trickles down.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, offices will be the face of the member. So that's, I think you see that as well.
Okay. And talking more specifically about the chief of staff role, what are your different responsibilities to constituents, to the staff, to the boss? I know you've touched on it a little bit, but what else does the chief of staff role entail?
You know, each office is a little different, but I think, you know, obviously you have to manage. Obviously, you're the political, the number one political advisor. Everything goes through you. The district director, the ledge director, the comms director go through me, and then they have their own staff. You know, the way I run our operation, we have an open door. I mean, I want the LD, and I want district director, I want our staff assistant, I want everyone to be able to talk directly to Vicky, and they do. I think that's important. But the member cannot make decisions on everything, so the chief is there to make the decisions on things. And if it needs to be elevated to the member, that'll happen. So I think a chief of staff, we make a lot of decisions on a day-to-day basis. We give a lot of guidance. We answer a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of set the tone. I think in a lot of ways, I think a chief of staff is the GM and the coach of a team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we coach on a day-to-day basis, but we also are the GM in that we have to put the pieces in place.
Mm-hmm.
To win the games, and I guess the member would be the owner, you know, dipping in when they want,
sure,
and stepping out when they want,
right.
But it's an odd job, it's an odd place,
right? Because the members come and go, right? I mean, they're back and forth, especially if they're in a district that's far away, and as a chief of staff, you're sort of the constant in the office, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, since you've been a chief for three different offices, you know, and I think you started out in the late 90s, early 2000s, you were working in a congressional office. So just do you have any observations about how these offices have changed, if at all, between now and 2017?
Oh, they've changed so much. They've changed so much.
How so?
Well, first of all, I think today, if you look at the Congress, and I don't have data on this directly. There is data out there, mm-hmm. but I want to say I would bet that half of the Congress right now was not here during regular order. Mm-hmm. When the Congress ran in regular order,
mm-hmm. Explain.
Regular order is when you basically run according to how you're supposed to run. Like, let's say the appropriations process, for instance, where the House would pass the individual appropriations bills, the Senate would pass theirs, they would then come to conference, they would bang out a compromise on each one, they would then pass it, and the president would sign it into law.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make up the different pillars of the appropriations process for the government.
Right.
It's called regular order. That's how we work.
Mm-hmm.
The committees would mark up the bills, and that was how we kept sanity.
Mm-hmm.
That does not happen anymore. We are in the world of minibuses and omnibuses and cromnibuses and CRs and all these types of things. And so I would bet half of the House of Representatives didn't serve in Congress when we had regular order. So.
And similarly, their staffs wouldn't, for the most part, most of their staffs wouldn't have experienced it either.
Wouldn't have experienced it either.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in a life of CRs and omnibuses and cromnibuses and minibuses, that's their norm. And that's not okay, because it's affecting how we operate in Congress. So I think that has definitely changed. I think that all of the different reforms that have went through, following scandals and as each party would come in, the Republicans would take over, they would do their reforms, the Democrats would take over and do their reforms, Republicans would come back in and do their reforms. The reasons that power have switched often was the case is that you would take over Congress because you would blame the other party for mismanagement of Congress. So of course you have to come in with reform because that's what got you there to begin with. Mm-hmm. But these reforms have swung, it's a pendulum that has swung way too far.
Mm-hmm. And can you give some examples?
Actually, travel, for instance. Okay, so back in the 90s and the early 2000s, there were a lot of CODELs, congressional delegation trips, that were often funded by outside groups. So they came in and they got rid of that for the most part because they were ethically, there were some issues. That's true, there were, and there needed to be some reform. Mm-hmm. But in my opinion, the pendulum has swung too far in that these don't occur anymore, and so these members don't travel with each other. And when they don't travel with each other, they don't get to know each other.
Right.
So right now, you have Democrats and Republicans who do not know each other and have no reason to work together because they're just a face on an opposing team. When these members would travel together, they would go on these 10-day trips where they would hit two or three countries. They actually have been on these trips. You actually do work pretty hard.
Right.
And Republicans and Democrats would travel together. Sometimes, you know, the members would give the option of, out of their own pocket, paying for their spouse to accompany. So the spouses would be there sometimes. Mm-hmm. So now you would have a Democrat and a Republican that would spend 10 days together, eating together, talking together, riding buses together, sitting on flights together. Yes, sometimes golfing together. And they got to know their spouse. They learned about their families. They learned about what makes them tick. They found things that were common ground. They would then get back to Washington and they would work together. It's a lot harder to vilify somebody on their side of the aisle when you've met their wife and you know that you share a common interest in adoption, for instance. Mm-hmm. But that's gone. That doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. So as often I equate it to, you know, you and I work at a company. I'm in sales, you're in accounting. And the only times we see each other is in the cafeteria when we walk by. There's no reason for me to stop and talk to you. There's no reason for you to talk to me. We have nothing in common. So why in the world are we going to work together, especially in politics, if we're on opposite sides, if we don't know each other? So we've kind of just completely gotten rid of that. Another instance for reform is member pay raises. You know, I mean, the Congress won't give itself a raise. Mm-hmm. And they pat themselves on the back and they send out a press release saying that they oppose a member pay raise. Well, at the same time, you're not getting people who are running for Congress anymore because the pay, I'm one of the people who actually say it, these members of Congress need to actually get a raise. They have to hold two residences. So you're asking someone who's coming from, I don't know where, name a part of the country, let's say he's coming from California, where you have to have a residence in California, which is very expensive. Then you have to come out here and have a residence in Washington, which is very expensive. A lot of members, since they spend so much time out here, their spouses, a lot of them do not hold a full-time job because they're out there raising the family. So suddenly $174,000 is not a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So who's going to run and really put their house for family in financial hardship by doing that?
Sure. I think the trend has been that it's the more affluent individuals who...
Right.
Who
people who don't need the money.
Right.
Or activists who they're really not driven by this anyways. Mm-hmm. So you're losing that middle ground type of member who's representing the people.
Right.
You run into that. And then what happens is that when you cap member pay, you can't raise staff pay because a staffer can't make more than a member. So what happens is that you get bottlenecked. So we lose expertise. So these things have changed. You know, it's become younger, which is fine, but with youth, you don't have as much experience. And even for really good members, it's harder to keep staff. It's hard to look at a really hardworking 27-year-old who spends 55, 60 hours a week in the office. Really, really talented person. It's hard to look at them in the eye and say, I might be able to get you $2,000 this year, when their friends work downtown, make twice their salary. It's really hard for them to say, do it for your country, when they can't pay their bills.
Right. And it's an expensive town.
It's extremely expensive.
So in part, it's not just that people they don't have ideas or they don't want to pursue those ideas. It's just if they want to live around here,
right,
they have to find work elsewhere.
It's hard. Mm-hmm. So I think from that, you know, fielding a strong office is difficult to do that. So that's hard. I think also dealing with, I think social media has made Congress somewhat petty,
mm-hmm.
and that's hard to deal with. And when you come out
well,
of
that's a change that you wouldn't have had, you know, when you first started out. That's
right.
Something that's
huge. Yeah. It's a huge difference. And you know, when you come out of an environment where you want to really focus on policy and you want to get things done, and you know, in the 90s and the mid 2000s, when Congress worked together and they actually did get things done, and now social media has kind of given the extremes a lever to pull. That causes Congress to come to a halt in times. That's been challenging. It's hard to see that. But from the upside, I think you know, it's really good to get behind when you have a really good member who you believe in, mm-hmm. and you know they're here for the right reasons. And when you can pull a team together, and you can, you know, the happy warrior scenario, right, where you can really make some change. I mean, Vicky got a FEMA reform bill. We get a lot of flooding in Missouri, and we got a bill passed that reforms FEMA, makes FEMA better. Got it through the Senate. It's actually at the White House as we speak. We expect it to become law. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that makes a difference, right? So just seeing it, watching a team work hard, and then at the end, you know, see it come to fruition, that's really worth it.
So what are some other changes along the way that you've noticed that need reform? I mean, do you have a viewpoint one way or the other, for instance, on earmarks?
Yeah. So I think earmarks falls into that category of, again, the pendulum swinging too far. There's no doubt that earmarks were abused.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt. They were. But the problem with the ban on earmarks is that we get back to that appropriations process,
mm-hmm.
where if you do not have earmarks, you're, first of all, ceding all authority to the executive branch. So right now, Congress, the authority of Congress is, of course, the Congress has the power of the purse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not always. You know, we'll send our spending bills to the White House, and we are basically in these bills saying, okay, well, Mr. President, it's up to you to decide where this funding is going to go. When really, that's the power of the legislative branch. But more importantly, I think that we've seen a lot of the stalling of spending bills moving through Congress because members don't have a skin in the game. So you need to move, let's say you need to move agriculture through, okay? All right, if you just have a straight, flat-out ag bill and you don't have earmarks in that bill for members in their areas, then there's not an impetus for them to get out there and want it to pass. And so what happens is it's not a priority. And if it's not a priority, it dies on the vine. And then we get these omnibuses and minibuses and everything else. So I think they need to find a way to allow for specific spending earmarks within these bills that demonstrate that it is not being driven by special interests. A couple ways to do that. One, I think you have to be transparent. Every earmark you put forward and you request should be transparent.
Mm-hmm.
It should go on a website. So constituents can tell, okay, my member just asked for these four earmarks. What are they? I think that would keep some honest brokerage going on. But two, I think if we found a way to just have it maybe with state local governments, right? So I live in Stafford County in Virginia, so which is Congressman Whitman's district. So, you know, I think that if Rob put forward amendment or earmarks where the county of Stafford is asking for help for an exit off of a highway because of erosion, okay, $5 million earmark to get that fixed, right? They're not bankrolling a member's campaign with that.
Mm-hmm.
So there are compromises. There are ways to do that we can get these back in to give the Congress the power that they should have. But also to get these bills moving a little bit.
What are your thoughts on the legislative calendar? I mean, how many actual work days the members are in town for each year?
You know, I know the calendar is a big hot button issue. A lot of people like to talk about that. The press loves to say the Congress is always on vacation. First of all, if any member of the press wants to go back and follow a member on a district work period week and go to all the different events that they hit, and see some of the stuff that they deal with, mm-hmm. I don't think anyone in their right mind would call it a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Far from it. I mean, my boss is scheduled today. She's she's jam-packed all through the day back in Missouri. So, you know, it really depends on the perception and what people want to say. So,
right, but let me just push back a little bit. So I don't know that necessarily the argument is that congressmen and women are lazy or that they're not doing work, but I think some might argue that they're not spending the time being together in Washington to hammer out the things they need to hammer out legislatively. If you're only there for 3 days and you're spending time meeting with constituents and raising money a third of the time, you're already on a shortened schedule. So is there really sufficient time for members to meet with each other to really hash out some of the more important issues?
You know, and I think that raises an interesting question of what do congressmen do? Mm-hmm. Right? So, because you'll hear the press say that a lot. You know, they're not here. They're not in Washington. They're not working. Well, what's the role of a member of Congress? Because I do know that when they're in Washington, we will hear back from the district, when's she going to be home? When's she going to do a town hall? When are we going to see her? We never see her. We never see her. Well, mm-hmm. we've been in Washington for 6 straight weeks. You know, and then when we're up here, then the D.C. press will say, you know, they're never going home. They're never going home. Or, oh, now they're breaking. Now they're going on vacation. Break. So I think it really depends on what congressmen do. A lot of the work that you talk about is actually gets done in committee. Mm-hmm. So I do know that a lot of times you'll see every summer, if our appropriations bills are lagging behind, there'll always be some members that'll come out and say, cancel August recess. Well, you can, but it's not going to speed the appropriations bills up because most of these members have nothing to do with the appropriations bills. Mm-hmm. So they'd be sitting around here in August, but they're rank and file. They're not making these decisions. So I think when we look at it and we take a closer look at what a member's supposed to really do, I think they work a lot more than people give them credit for. And to actually be in D.C., if there's work to be done here, they should be here. But I don't think we want members of Congress sitting around with idle time when leadership and committees are banging things out.
Sure, but again, to push back a little, given this year, 2017, in terms of major legislative accomplishments one way or the other, there doesn't seem to be much going on, at least from an outsider's perspective. And you say...
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's definitely fair. So I guess we would just need to look and say, okay, well, having the whole Congress here in town, would that change things? I mean, is the problem because they're not here, or is the problem at a leadership struggle? Is it a problem at the leadership? Is it a problem you need 60 votes in the Senate to get anything through? Is the problem because the White House isn't playing ball? I mean, I think there's a lot of other things at play here than whether or not members are physically in Washington.
Sure, absolutely. And that's why we have a whole initiative sort of focused in on the legislative branch, because I think it is multifaceted. There are a lot of different things to explore.
Yeah.
Are there other areas that you have observed about the institution itself that you think are dysfunctional that you'd like to see changed?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, dysfunctional is a tough word because I will say that people work hard up here. They do. And I just think we've kind of found ourselves in a new normal. You know, I talk about...
I can hear the people out in America saying, we work hard out here too. Like,
yeah, no, they do. They absolutely do.
Sure.
But I think, you know, we have a problem. And the problem is that we have members of Congress, and we've talked about this before, that are, we've ran our moderates out. On both sides of the party, mm-hmm. and both parties have ran their moderates out. So now we have two entrenched sides that are punished if they compromise. They're rewarded if they don't compromise, because no one wants to get a primary in their elections. So we have two sides that really don't want to give a little. And so we've run into this problem of gridlock. And I think a lot of it has to do with the media. I think a lot of it has to do with this 24-hour news cycle and the need to dust up things that make news out of things that really aren't news. We go back to the member pay raise. I remember the member pay raise was something that was kind of automatic. It would be like a COLA. It would be involved in the budget. And actually, it was one of these things where both
Just
sides...
Just for the audience, what's a
COLA? Cost of living adjustment. Mm-hmm. Both sides would agree to not attack each other for this. And then down the line, I think it was 2006, I think when the Dems took over, suddenly it became fair game. And it was turned over to talk radio and social media, and boom, member pay raise became a giant thing. And it became a political football. So did the debt ceiling, became a political football. And now members won't move on any of these things, and now the debt ceiling shuts the government down. So I just think that's just the dynamics of change. And I don't know how you get back. It's kind of like the Cold War, right? You got both sides staring at each other and no one wants to blink. But somebody has to give, right? And somebody has to, or someone has to compromise and say, okay, we need to figure some of these things out.
Chris, I wanted to ask you, you've clearly worked in a lot of interesting and different places. I'm curious if you could share with us a favorite memory or interesting person from those experiences on the Hill.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. You meet a lot of interesting people. I met a lot of interesting people up there. I would say, though, that the one that really stands out, you know, you meet a lot of celebrities, you meet a lot of athletes, which, you know, at this stage, I honestly don't care about. But one thing that stood out is I met Neil Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that still blows my mind.
Wow.
That this guy stepped on another planet. The guy walked out of a spaceship and stepped on another planet.
What office were you working in, and what was the circumstances of meeting him?
I want to say I was in Ridgel's office. Okay. Yeah, I was in Ridgel's office, and he was in for a hearing.
Oh, okay.
In that we had NASA wallops, so we had a NASA connection.
In Virginia, too.
In Virginia, too. Right. We had a NASA connection. And so I went down and I met him. And it blew my mind. It really did. He truly was an American hero.
So we talked about how, the office is tight-knit and you're all working together. And it's important, I think, at least from my interactions with you, that to keep everyone in good spirits and have some fun. I was wondering if maybe you could – I know there are probably many anecdotes, but there was one anecdote about you sending one of your staffers on his first flight, if you could tell us about that.
Sure. We did. Scott, he was in our office. He was probably 25, 26. We found out he had never been on an airplane before. So that just didn't make much sense. You know, you're living in the big city.
Right.
So for his birthday, we...
He was Georgia. Georgia, right.
Georgia. So, Ole Miss guy from Georgia.
That's right.
So we gave him a... for his birthday, we gave him a round-trip airline ticket to Buffalo in January. And it was one day... And you got on the plane, you flew to Buffalo, you landed, he had about an hour and a half, then he got back on the plane and came back. And I grew up there, so I know the worst time to go, and I know the worst time of the day to go. And we sent him there so he would be able to witness the purple hue of the sky around 4 o'clock in January, and what seemed like possibly a dim light bulb hanging in the sky behind a lot of purple clouds, which would be the sun. And yeah, we did that to him, and he came back. And you know, when he wasn't real happy about it, but we're like, you can't waste our money. You gotta go. It turned out he was afraid of flying, is why he didn't.
Oh,
I see. Yeah, so we sent him up in a blizzard.
And to be clear, this was not the office's money. This was all of you chipping in on that, right?
Correct. This was all staff. This was all staff. We also, another quick one is we had a girl in our front office who her desk was in the middle office, and her behind her was the wall, and so every day when she went to go to lunch, me and another guy would get up and we would move her desk about half an inch back. So over about 3 weeks, it gradually became where she was behind the desk in a corner, could barely move, but because it was done gradually, she never really noticed what was going on. And she started becoming real conscious, and she said to Beth, at one point, Beth, I don't know what's going on. I don't know if I'm gaining weight, but I can't fit behind my desk anymore. So... Yeah.
Did you confess or?
Yeah, we eventually told her. We did. We eventually told her. And in my new office, I was on vacation. I made the mistake of sending a picture of the beach while they were all at work. And I came back and my entire desk and every single thing on the desk and everything in the desk was wrapped in foil.
So what about this current year? What are your thoughts and perspective on how things have been going in Congress? For 2017.
It's been a heck of a year. I don't think anyone really knew what they were going to get out of this White House. I think if someone were to ask me right now, for instance, how is it working with the Trump administration and how's the Trump administration doing, I would say, I don't know. I don't think we know yet.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of ideas coming out of the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to move on those ideas. I mean, we did our best with Obamacare. I think it became apparent that there just wasn't the appetite there to really make some of the big changes that some of these members were promising were going to happen.
The appetite in the Senate or in both?
Well, the House passed stuff. The Senate didn't.
Right.
So I would say the Senate. And now we're on a tax reform. I think sometimes what makes this challenging is we're out there messaging tax reform, and then over the weekend the White House comes out with a giant immigration, 70-step immigration order. So it sometimes from a messaging perspective, it becomes difficult to stay on target. Mm-hmm. But the White House is not short of ideas, and I give them credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think right now we're trying to get things through. But, you know, let's face it, there's more than two parties in Congress right now. There's three, maybe four.
Mm-hmm.
I guess on paper, Republicans have a majority, but realistically, they don't. And that, coupled with the fact that there's a 60-vote threshold in the Senate, makes it incredibly hard to get anything through. You know, I know that the president will pick to Neil Gorsuch as an accomplishment. And some people are like, what, you just nominated a Supreme Court justice? Well, yeah, but the fact that they changed the rules to get him in is significant.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just the cards that were dealt right now. So I think right now, as far as how this year's going, I don't know yet. And of course, from a foreign policy perspective, I mean, North Korea, that's a concern. So there's a lot going on.
So do you have any anticipation that there'll be tax reform or anything else before the end of the year? Obviously, I'm asking you to prognosticate.
Yeah, I mean, look, I would say that there definitely is more. I've the momentum I think we're feeling from tax reform is much stronger than it was for repeal and replace of Obamacare. I mean, I think the idea that we could get a health care bill through the House was real, but I think by and large, it probably was going to stop there. Okay, and even if the Senate moved theirs out, then we would have to conference something, and that would be hard. But I think with tax reform, there's a lot more possibilities there.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that some Democrats, it's worth talking to some Democrats. I think that there are some Democrats out there that understand that tax reform will help their constituents. I mean, look, whether or not you agree with the ideas within the tax reform bill is one thing, but no one can deny the fact that we are dealing with a tax code that was, I mean, I was a kid. I was a tiny little kid mm-hmm. the last time we changed our taxes. And you can't win on a 35-year-old playbook or however old this thing is. So I do. I think there was some momentum.
So you're optimistic. Somewhat optimistic.
Yeah, to some extent, sure.
Sure. And just wrapping up in terms of your thoughts and recommendations for Congress, what do you have any that are specific to the House or specific to the Senate that you'd like to share with us from your perspective?
Just overall recommendations?
Yeah. 20 years on the Hill, a current chief of staff for three different offices.
Yeah. First, if anyone out there that ever wants to get on the Hill, I mean, we need really smart people. We need good people. We need people that are going to take this seriously. You know, just this is anecdotal and just kind of out there on the fly. But one of my things that I've always been harping on is we've lost the art of writing on the Hill.
Mm.
We need more writers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something I know this is kind of out there, but it's always been in the back of my mind is we need more writers. This sounds like a weird idea, but I have often thought too that I think members of Congress should get a housing allowance. If they, I would love to see the old Page dorms or some of these older buildings that are around. I would love to see those renovated as dormitories for members of Congress,
mm-hmm.
and they would have the option of staying in these dorms. And no Republican Democrat dorms; they all stay together, right? All right, we're not splitting up.
Right.
To kind of help out, because I do really think that I know it sounds crazy. A lot of people are going to think I'm insane, but it is hard for members to meet the expenses that they get. And I would love to see these people spend more time together, because I really do think that when you spend time together and you see someone as a human being, compromise becomes a lot easier. And I've always said that. People think I'm crazy, but I'd love to see them do that. So have member dorms. There's my crazy idea.
Well, as to the first idea, it actually segues into our repeat plug for our writing contest, which the Article 1 initiative has started. It's open to all eligible individuals under the age of 40. The topic is restoring the Constitutional Congress. We're looking for a maximum of 30 pages and a deadline for submission in January 5th of next year. Top prize on that is $5,000. You can learn more by visiting fedsoc.org/AI contest. fedsoc.org/AI contest. Chris, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. What do you got against 40-year-olds?
We're trying to push young people who will come work and be great staffers in Congress. We're trying to encourage them to think about Congress and the Constitution. And for the record, I have nothing against people over 40. On behalf of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative, Chris, thank you for speaking with us today.
Hey, appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article 1 Initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.